Hi, and welcome to the Inclusive Workplace podcast. I'm Ursula Tavender, and I'm so happy that you're here with us as we tell the stories of how organisations are navigating the most pressing inclusion issues. Thank you for being here. Hi, and welcome back to the Inclusive Workplace podcast. I'm Ursula Tavender, and today I am really, really excited to be joined by two great friends and colleagues of mine, Dagmar Albers and Ella Warren. Dagmar, can you introduce yourself, please?
Yes. Hello, everybody. And of course I can. So I am Dagmar, and I used to be the Diversity, Equity and Inclusion Lead at Pfizer in the UK, with an interesting main aim to close the gender and later on the ethnicity pay gap. I have designed and implemented the strategy we use to halve the gender pay gap in just 3 years. And Ursula here was one of my main supporters and consultant at the time. And funnily enough, Ella used to be my wonderful undergraduate or student at the time, supporting me for a whole year, having her work experience with us. I actually left Pfizer at the end of June, and because I couldn't let Ursula go, I'm still in contact with Ella, obviously, we co-founded Innovation and Equity, which is a collaboration between the two of us, Ursula and I, to continue the award-winning work we did do together. Yeah, over to Ella, I guess.
Thank you.
Hi, so yeah, I'm Ella. I joined Dagmar in 2019 as her undergraduate. I'm also a full-time wheelchair user and the chair of the WizKids Kids Board since June of last year, but I've been working and active with WizKids on the board since 2019 as well.
You do some incredible work with them, Ella. Thank you. And I'm hoping that we might be able to hear a little bit about it throughout this conversation. So we wanted to come together today to have a conversation, which we hope will illustrate to employers and leaders listening the benefits of removing barriers to work for people with different abilities. And we also wanted to share some really practical insights and your experiences of working together so that everyone listening will get some inspiration for how to create a really fantastic employee experience and make work more accessible for everyone. So I'm really grateful to you both for making the time to talk to me today. Ella, I would love to talk to you about your experiences with accessibility in the workplaces that you've been in. Can you tell us a little bit about your experiences?
Yeah, so I've been working, I worked both before my honours that put me in my wheelchair and after. So I have one version of the workplace as an able-bodied person and one as a disabled person. So I'm able to quite starkly see the differences between my treatment. So I, however, have worked primarily since being in my wheelchair. So I've worked for a variety of companies across a variety of sectors, such as leisure, construction, obviously Pfizer, doing various roles from receptionists, style roles to undergraduate role, helping Dagmar close the gender pay gap to HR. I also freelance a little bit in disability advocacy work and accessibility consulting for organisations across the UK. So in terms of disability in the workplace, I think usually I'm a user they've had in that or in their workplace. I'm usually the first person they've even thought about having the conversation for. When it comes to experiences, they've also often been defined how willing the person is to discuss it and the open-mindedness of an organisation to be able to adapt as I need. Generally, a lot of my negative experiences have been in the interest, and I've never actually progressed to employment with those people because the accessibility have just been too great. Whereas I would have seen them as very easy to navigate, I think the company saw them as too massive, so therefore it never progressed any further. So when I have then joined a workplace or an organisation, the access issues have usually been discussed quite a bit more. They're usually willing. So one organisation took the mindset of, I interviewed, they didn't know I was a wheelchair user, I just turned up, I never told them. And they rang me about 10 minutes after and said, look, I'm going to be completely honest with you, you're great, we want to employ you, I don't know how this works, what do we do? Because I'm not sure you can fit around the building properly. I don't know if it's going to be suitable for your needs. So the person said, well, just come back in. Let's say you're going to get the job hypothetically, but let's just figure out if this actually worked. So, you know, I couldn't fit behind the desk. That was the first thing. So they just took all the doors off so I could fit. And that was the solution. Other workplaces haven't, I think, been quite as open to discuss their fears. They've kind of just thought, we'll figure it out. And then they've changed things when I brought them up, but not before. They've not sort of asked openly. I think generally there's always a bit of trial and error as well in most workplaces. Mm-hmm. Of course, when I talk about accessibility for me, I don't just mean my wheelchair. Accessibility for me also has to consider my assistant's dog, who needs a safe space to work as well. So, for example, some organisations have responded by putting in things for him, which have been very helpful for me, like bins that are easy for me to access, toileting spaces for him. Other organisations have just thought that the current infrastructure is suitable, which has provided a few changes for me, such as like there was no bin in about a mile, so I had to walk quite far. And then when it comes to sort of the day-to-day role and accessibility, you know, in performing my job, generally because of my role and because of what I choose to work in HR, a lot of it is desk-based, so I don't need huge amounts of adjustments for that to happen, which I think is a benefit for me. But generally, the best accessibility comes with flexibility for me.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And what impact does it have on you when you've had that variety of experiences? And you are met with, okay, how, we're not quite sure we've got all the answers, but, you know, how can we make this work versus an experience of a bit more of a kind of more barriers being put up? What is the impact that has on you? I'd just really love to talk to you about that.
When there's a lot of barriers, I generally won't stay in that setting very long at all. When there's a lot of barriers, it really negatively impacts my ability to perform at my best at my job. It really affects usually my mental health and also my physical health, because I spend a lot of time then navigating things that I shouldn't really need to navigate, and it just puts a lot of extra strain on me. When there's barriers, it just makes me feel even more isolated from that workplace as well, because if there are barriers, I'll be the only disabled person in that setting, which I am normally anyway, but it means that those are very, very clear and very obvious to me. It leads to exclusion without meaning to as well, because often things are just easier if someone else does it than me. And therefore I don't get to be fully included. And I think, you know, the long-term impacts of barriers in the workplace mean that I'd have limited chances for progression. Unlike other people, I'm in my early 20s. That's the time when you're building your career. But if, for example, you can't access the space that the networking events are held in, you then have much longer lasting career effects because you don't build those connections right at the start, unlike other people. So I think when people look at accessibility barriers, they often consider the physical barriers and the very quick fix ones in some ways. But actually, you know, it takes a lot of time to navigate the impacts of, such as I can't get into one room one day, but that event was written. Going forward, it kind of sticks with me, and I think it disadvantages me for potentially my whole career. And the other thing for me is accessibility barriers around people's attitudes as well, you know, their biases they have against me, the way they view me. You know, I think a lot of people often haven't come across a wheelchair user before. And so I have to navigate difficult conversation with people who might be senior colleagues to myself who I've never met before, who ask what's wrong with me as the first thing they ask me. And, you know, if they asked me that in the street, I'd be quite short with them. But obviously, because it's a workplace environment, I have to consider how I navigate that response. So, you know, the barriers really, really stack up a lot of the time. And it can even be something as simple as I go to a conference and a lot of distract my assistant's dog, which means I then end up leaving the room because I need a break and he needs a break. And I need to worry about my own health in a way that he can actually do that without being interrupted. But then I miss an important part of the speech or whatever. So I think for me, the impact of accessibility barriers is huge, but I probably don't always notice them as well because I navigate them in day in, day out, and therefore they just become part of every day to me.
I remember having one of the most powerful workplace conversations I've ever had with you not long after you joined Pfizer, and you talked about how meeting colleagues, because of when you joined and the pandemic happening at a similar time, when you met lots of colleagues at Pfizer for the first time, it was virtually over Teams, wasn't it? And you talked about how like that there was a huge difference in how you could build relationships with those colleagues and how you worked with them because you worked virtually. So I wondered if you could speak to that.
Yes, when I joined Pfizer, I remember me and sort of Dagmar had a conversation and basically said, well, a lot of these people won't know you're a wheelchair user. And at that time, for context, I very carefully removed any trace of my wheelchair from social media, from LinkedIn, anything. My WizKid stuff was under a different, was under my middle name, so as to keep, so you could connect the two, to very much almost give myself the best chance of appearing normal to employers and those around me, to try and reduce the bias in the way I was treated. So when I joined Pfizer, we kind of had this conversation. We had a really unique opportunity to see what happened if they didn't know I was a wheelchair user, because the only thing that I'd be able to tell them would be through telling them. That's the only way they could probably tell. Because my disability, you know, I'm sat in a chair just like everyone else at that point. So it was a good few months before people started to sort of find out I was a wheelchair user. And I think for the first time since I was in my chair, it's very hard to put into words just how subtle but yet obvious to me the treatment of me was. You know, I was very much still one of them. They didn't sort of treat me differently because I was disabled. And I don't think there's ever been a malintent, or, you know, it wasn't ever a deliberate thing. But I think people have a level of comfort in similarity in speaking to people like themselves, able-bodied, over someone who's different, like myself, who's obviously disabled. I think that level of comfort remained, and that changed their interactions with me. And I think what was really key as well was that, you know, there was no kind of, it wasn't deliberately hidden. It wasn't, you know, if someone asked me outright, I wouldn't have said, no, I'm not a wheelchair user. It was very subtly, you know, when it did start to come up, it wasn't sort of addressed massively. And I think also they were never confronted with the physical reality of it. Like, you know, my current colleagues, for example, would have to consider, you know, if we wanted to go to a shop, like, oh, has it got steps into it just on lunch break or something? But they never had to think like that. They never had to come up with the physical reality of the fact that I sat, you know, next to them while they stood up, or, you know, that they'd have to take a lift everywhere if they came anywhere with me rather than the stairs. I think because they didn't have to confront the physical realities of it, it also made it easier for them when they were introduced to it, because it was still just a concept to them. It wasn't a reality. So that, I think, also altered it. But it was really, really interesting to me to have that experience and to see the differences in people's reactions.
Was it really obvious, the difference?
In some people, yes. And I think some people took it as they've been sort of deceived a little bit. I think a lot of people feel they're owed my life history and owed to know what happened to me and owed to know my disability.
Okay.
And then when I sort of take that opportunity away, it's like I've taken away something so fundamental to myself and it changes me as a person. And I think it forces people then to confront this little voice in their head that kind of goes, oh, they aren't actually that different to us. But their brain goes, but they are, they're a wheelchair, they must be vastly different to you. You must know this about them in order to know them as a person. And I think that challenges a lot of people's thinking when it comes to disability. And I think they found that perhaps themselves quite difficult to make those two halves meet, because I don't think they had quite the understanding of, you know, things that I do, like disability culture, disability norms. And I think that did have an impact as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's so, Dagmar, did you, given everything that Ella's just talked about, did you feel that you were maybe taking a risk by choosing her as your undergrad? Let's take aside, you know, for a second how utterly brilliant she is. But in terms of her disability, did you feel that that was risky?
No, not at all, actually, because I'm a huge fan of risk mitigation, not the first thing, right? So yes, maybe there was a, of course there are always risks, right? Like, is the site appropriate? Can she make it? Things pop up I haven't even thought about. One really good example is, let's start from the beginning. So when she came in, or application for the job, I was just like, so, ooh, she sounds really interesting. So I invited her to do this video thing, where she was very cool and very to the point. And I was like, so, this girl is very interesting. So we invited her to the assessment center, right? And because at that point I knew then that she was in a wheelchair, it wasn't that clear in the interview or on the video. I was not panicking, but very, very aware. I need to make it as easy for her as possible to come to this interview, because it's already strenuous coming to an interview into an assessment center, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, there had been hurdles I didn't even think about. I wasn't aware, because I thought it's just enough to have a wheelchair entrance, for example. You know, I made everybody aware there is a person coming with a wheelchair. So I did everything I could, and still it didn't work out the way we wanted, because when you come to the site, there's a little house, a gatehouse, where you have to go to security to check in, right? What I wasn't totally aware of, and I didn't even think about it, you know. How could I even, you know, not being aware of it, that she came with her car, and then she had to go out of her car, get the wheelchair out, roll up to the thing, which you can do easily, apparently, right, check in, and then to do the whole thing back, you know. But that did cost her 20 minutes. So yeah. I've been waiting for her. I knew she was coming, but she's already been like 15 minutes late, which wasn't good for her preparing for an interview. And I was like, so, oh my God, hopefully nothing has happened, you know. A little thing, like she told me later, it would be great if you would have a button there so I just can ring them and they can come out to me so I don't need to get out of my car. And I thought, yeah, it makes total sense, right? Then the interview itself and the assessment center was brilliant, because the Pfizer offices are quite adapted to that. However, I knew getting her up in the lifts, that the lifts haven't been 100%. So one of the risk mitigations I did before she started was, Ella, can you come at whole day? I arranged with facility management to go with you through the site to see, is it actually appropriate or not, for example, right? So, and then facility management said, oh, we are all set up. And Ella said, yes, you're doing really well, but there are quite a few things you can do better. Like, interesting point Ella pointed out, we went to the disability toilets, which you have there, but the cord for emergency, for example, the cleaners, I think, hung it up in the air, you know. And Ella said, so if I fall out of my wheelchair, which is the one thing which might happen to me, is I can't reach that cord because I'm laying actually on the floor. And facility management was like, so oops, maybe we better look into this, right? Or the bin in the corner, great that you have a bin, but you have to open it with a foot. I can't use my feet, can I? Mm. Right? And Ella has a great way of being sarcastic, which is wonderful. The way she said, you know, she made us all smile, because it was just so obvious. But of course, if you're not in that situation, you don't think about. And another really good example was, like, she nearly said no to the job. So I offered her the role, because I really wanted her. I offered her the role. And then at one point, she came back and said, I'm not sure I can do it, because in the moment, I just can't find affordable housing. I'm just a student, so I don't swim in money, right? But I need a flat which is actually appropriate for me and my needs, which hardly exists down here, right? And I was like, so, oh, what are we going to do about this? So these kind of things you simply don't think about, because you're not in that situation, but opened my mind up massively. Does that answer your question? So I've seen the risks, but I didn't see it as a risk, because I knew she would be brilliant and I really, really wanted her.
And that's the, what I hear in both of what you're saying is the same message, that actually it's the lived experience and listening to people that is what counts here, because the intention can be really good, right? You know, you did as much as you felt you could to make it accessible and welcoming as an environment and inclusive for Ella, and yet that still wasn't enough because you don't have that lived experience. So the fact that you were so open to hearing and learning from her, and, you know, we both learned so much from you, Ella, over that year, and we'll always be grateful for that, because it's helped us immeasurably in our work moving forward. But it's really interesting to me that even though you did all of that, Dagmar, it still wasn't enough. You know, it wasn't enough so that you could get to the interview on time, Ella, and it wasn't enough so that you could use the accessible toilets, and, you know, the list goes on. So I think this is so valuable to leaders and to employers, because what I hear is it's the openness to learning that almost matters as much as making the adjustments themselves.
Yes, and I think, and also then the next stage was, of course, COVID came and she had to work from home, which was brilliant, the best solution ever, actually, because mm-hmm. then people could see even that she was in a wheelchair. But it was quite interesting, because what I then learned over this whole year with Ella, you know, working from home, sitting in a wheelchair comes with a lot of challenges. So as you said, I learned so much from Ella. I didn't know, like, then we had this massive heat wave. So it was the summer of the summers, right? So we had this massive heat wave. And what I didn't realize, what Ella hated about me, that is, even though through the camera, I could sometimes see or feel how she felt. And we had moments where I said, Ella, you're not feeling very well today. So what is going on? And then she explained, look, it's really hot today. And if you're sitting in a wheelchair, if you're paralyzed like I am, I actually can't sweat in my lower half. I don't sweat, right? And that is why I'm prone to overheating. And I was like, what? You know? And I can't even say then put your feet into a bowl of water, because I don't think that would have the same effect as it would have for me. You know, so these things you are learning is, so my biggest thing was always like, never ever make assumptions, mm-hmm. always ask the question, you know, like, what is going on? What do you need? Or what I didn't realize is sitting all the time in a wheelchair can be quite uncomfortable. And she said to me, don't be surprised when I'm all of a sudden sitting in front, I'm doing the next meeting in front of my sofa and I'm sitting on the floor. I just every now and then need that, or every now and then I might even do it from my bed, because sometimes I just need to lay down because it's getting strenuous or I'm getting sores or whatever, you know. So really, really ask the questions. And I'm a huge fan, as you know, about active listening. I mean, there's a reason why we have two ears and just one mouth, mm-hmm. right? So you need to listen double as much as you speak. And quite often I just ask all the questions, and even some of the questions, of course, been uncomfortable, but I was like, so yeah, I'm still asking them now because I want to know and I want to learn. I believe it was the right thing to do, because it helped me to get more into her shoes, even though I will never be in her shoes. Does that make sense what I'm saying here?
It makes perfect sense. And it's one of the things that's really stuck with me and struck me most about the relationship that you had, is that where others potentially may have held off and waited for Ella to say when you were struggling, Ella, Dagmar didn't wait. She, you know, I often saw between the two of you that, you know, you took the time to notice Dagmar and ask and to listen to the real honest answer about how you were, Ella. And I'd love to talk to you about the allyship piece and that kind of the importance of that relationship, and just, you know, interested to hear your experiences from that point of view, Ella.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, for me, working with Dagmar was sort of the first full-time role I'd had since being a wheelchair user. So it was a huge adaptation for me as well. And I think because she didn't give me opportunities to sort of suffer for long, it made the whole experience better, because, you know, it's quite daunting as a wheelchair user and as someone who is so aware that they're so different from the rest of the workforce and who's usually used to having to minimize her disability in order to be taken seriously and to almost feel deserving of that place in the workplace. It can be really challenging to then go, actually, I feel awful. I can't mm-hmm. focus, I can't work right now because of my disability. There's a running joke often between me and my wheelchair friends of, you know, we're always shocked when our disability actually disables us, because we very much have the attitude of, we can get out of it. We can, you know, as long as we work hard enough, it will solve all of my life problems and I won't be disabled anymore. And I think for me, what it meant was that I didn't have to almost put on this face, this brave face that everything was absolutely fine. And actually, you know, it was okay just to say, I can't sit up anymore, I'm in too much pain. And I think we developed quite a unique relationship and a unique way of working, which meant that Dagmar absolutely got the most out of me as well as an employee, because she knew how to work with me in a way that benefited me. Whereas I think if another employee hadn't been, or another person hadn't been able to see those signs, been as receptive and hadn't asked the questions, what would have ended up was have been a lot less of a beneficial working relationship, because I'd end up poorlier, I wouldn't tell people, my work would go lower quality and things like that, subtly, in a way that most people wouldn't notice. And of course, you know, the overall impact of that is negative, but by asking the questions and by asking them quite openly and quite honestly, it meant that, you know, we got a lot of hard conversations out the way very early on.
Mm-hmm.
I think what also helped was that, you know, obviously it was all virtual, but Dagmar learned how to read me very, very well. So I'm sure both us and Dagmar, but I tick, I have lots of spasms, things like that. So I'd often be in the back of a team meeting just whacking myself, you know, and having to deal with that. And so straight away there was a subtle thing of, oh, if Ella's camera goes off, you know, she's probably just having a tick or a spasm. Mm-hmm. And there was no questioning of, well, if you go on, you should be on camera. It was like, oh, okay, she's kicking, it's all kicking off. And the understanding was that I was still there, I was still present, and I was still able to participate. But, you know, for the sake of everyone else on the call, it probably wasn't better for me to leave my camera on. And little things like that, very, very subtle. But just having knowledge to know that that didn't mean I was disengaging, that I wasn't present. Mm-hmm. It just meant that right now that wasn't the opportunity for me to be on camera. And I think allyship is so, so important, because like I said before, I'm often the only one. And yeah. I think there is a really fine line and between allyship and sort of taking over and speaking for that person. It can be very difficult to navigate when you don't necessarily know the differences. And I think, you know, I've seen this a lot with my work as chair of the board and with WizKids, that a lot of organizations and employers and managers have the right thinking, and they want to be that ally, but they don't know how to be, because in reality, I've said this before, allyship is probably at several times going to make you uncomfortable, and it's going to challenge you. It's not easy to be an ally and a true ally, because you have to accept, in order to be a true ally, you have to be willing to accept that you are wrong and that you need to learn as well. And there are going to be times when the true sign of allyship is saying nothing, is doing nothing, is allowing something to happen that you might not think is the right thing, because you're relying on that person's lived experience and understanding of the world around them and the workplace. So I think when it comes to being an ally, you know, the open and honesty thinking is so important, and understanding that in reality is that if, you know, if you look around your workplace, if you look around who your employees are, do you have anyone other than that one person who looks like them, who has the same challenges that they do in the workplace? If the answer is no, then you truly have to consider the fact that then when you look around that workplace and see who you could relate to and what you have in common with, so you're probably going to find at least half you can relate to. So you can just imagine how it feels like to be the only person in a room or in a workplace that looks like you, that has the same challenges you do. And so that's where you begin your allyship point from, is thinking, okay, there's one of them, there's a lot of us. So, you know, in order to be a true ally, I have to listen to them. I can't listen to the majority here, because the majority don't know. The majority don't have the lived experience. And I think it's often quite challenging for people to then understand how those work together. And when it comes to sort of working with Pfizer, like Dan said, like that first interview date, you know, straight away, I was felt set apart from everyone else, because everyone else, it was easy just nip up to the A-house. For me, it was this whole big challenge.
Mm.
And I think, you know, from day one, it was very difficult, but, you know, one of the first things I was saying, it wasn't why are you late, it wasn't to question, like, it was basically like, what's wrong, are you okay? It wasn't from a place of, oh, she's late, this isn't a good thing. It was, hang on, what did I do? Like, what could I have done differently? And that is the true sign of allyship, is like, it wasn't the questioning of that it was my fault, or that it was a consequence of my disability. It wasn't viewed like that. It was viewed as a consequence of an access failure. And I think that was the really key point. You know, when you look to help a disabled employee and to be an ally, you know, don't look at it as, oh, their disability means they can't do this. First of all, look at it as, does the access mean they can't do this? Does the lack of support mean they can't do this? Because 9 times out of 10, we can probably do it with the right access and support and the right allyship, because
mm-hmm.
you know, we rely on those more senior managers, the leaders, to make the changes, because they have the say to do so. We don't have that say. We can say it all day in, day out, but it's only when those people in those roles take us seriously and hear it and hear what we are truly saying and implement according to what we are saying, that the workplace does become more accessible.
There is so much.
And if I may add.
Yeah, go for it.
And if I may add to that, and Ella, is all the stuff, because Ella was one of my earliest undergraduates when I started that role. I had quite a few afterwards. What I really, really learned from Ella is do not be afraid to ask these questions, because COVID, of course, had a huge impact, particularly on students. And you know all the students who came afterwards, right? And everyone had their own challenges, you know. Ella was in a wheelchair, but I had a few others. I had one with social anxiety, and some other ones, you know. And it was really, really interesting that I really learned to ask these questions and gain this understanding. And I think that is something what a manager needs to do anyway, you know, or people manager. You asking these questions and really understanding each other, where you come from. Also, because we are so different generations, you know. I'm Generation X, I think, or something like that. Ella is, of course, Z, you know. There is this kind of divide or different communication style and all the things which come from it, you know. But it doesn't need to be a barrier, because if you really ask the questions and try to understand, and that is then when you start learning and start understanding, and that really creates this trust you really need to have in a working relationship, and that then enabled everybody to work really and truly flexible. Because with Ella and all the other ones who came afterwards, I really learned to trust them and to look at what output they generated and to let go of this old-fashioned thinking of which hours they work or she worked, you know, when they worked, you know, because I knew they all deliver, because and I can trust they do deliver on time. So I didn't have to do this micromanagement, which in former years I very likely would have done, you know. But big learning curve for me too. And I think another learning is you need to let go, you know, and just trust. Because why do you otherwise give a person a role if you don't trust them? Mm-hmm. I think I had some long-lasting learnings from that, you know. And really interesting that now it really annoys me when people apologize for things they shouldn't apologize for, you know, because flexibility really helps to make it work. I think, I believe.
I'm totally with you on that. And I think that one of the things that jumped out at me most when Ella, when you were talking, was about the link between everything that you're saying and that flexibility and that understanding that really it's about, exactly as you've said, Dagmar, it's about the outcomes of the work that you do and the impact that you have, not the fact that you turn your camera off and, you know, all of those kind of things that people make assumptions about or might make assumptions about. But it starts with that curiosity, doesn't it? You know, it very much is about, you know, how can we do this better? And, you know, how can we support each other? And like you say, that applies to everyone. But especially, you know, when you've had and so I can't thank you enough, Ella, for so honestly and generously sharing your experiences with us, because I don't believe there's one person listening to this that can't learn from everything that you have made it your life's work to make things better for everyone and to share that. And I just think your work is incredible. Is there anything else that would make your experience and the other wheelchair users that you know and that you work with better or easier? Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you think employers need to know?
Yeah, I think obviously I do a lot of work around disability advocacy and, you know, making life better for wheelchair users across the UK, particularly young wheelchair users up to 25 is sort of where I work. And, you know, we have a manifesto for our board, and one of our big statement is always nothing about us without us. And I think, you know, for employers, a really key thing to understand is that you can make your workplace the most accessible place in the world, but the world isn't accessible. So I think one of the key things that, you know, I spend a lot of time talking about with at the moment is that, you know, we have employers that are offering great accessible opportunities, but for example, their office is in central London, but the nearest four tube stations aren't accessible, and they can't understand why they won't get wheelchair users applying for the roles, for example. So I think when you look at the accessibility of your workplace, you also, I think employers really need to consider the accessibility of the world. You know, I think in today's world, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of busy noise. There's a lot of things going on, and there's so much to consider and think about. But when you're looking at, you know, how to be an ally and how to help young wheelchair users and wheelchair users into employment, you've got to consider just beyond your employment. You know, like Dagmar said, I nearly turned down the role because I couldn't find anywhere to live. Quite simple. You know, I've got this role that I really wanted to be great for my career, but there was nothing within, I think it was a 60-mile radius I was looking, that was suitable. And I think, you know, an employer just even having that understanding, if you offer a role that involves relocation, for example, to a disabled employee, that they might not be able to take that up with the best will in the world because there is nothing that exists in that local area. So like me and Dagmar had a very honest conversation. Dagmar and her current undergrad helped try and find something. Obviously COVID happened. So actually in a weird way, it worked out perfectly for me. But you know, just kind of having the understanding that it isn't always going to be the easiest for someone. And that doesn't mean we're not as good as an able-bodied candidate or even sometimes better. Or that, you know, that we're not able to be in work or work hard. It's just that the barriers that you consider are often insurmountable. And I think that often sometimes gets lost in translation. So I think for employers and leaders, it's really important to consider, you know, around flexible working, hybrid working, working from home options, you know, how often an employee has travel. And these all will depend on an individual disabled person, individual wheelchair user. So for example, I drive, so for me, I have more flexibility than someone who doesn't drive, for example. But I think when you look at that and you look at your workplace, you've got to remember that even with the most accessible place, you might not be able to be accessible because of the world around it. And that's when, in my view, you start really becoming an ally, when you start listening to what we're saying and listening to our campaigns and the conversations that go on at in government level around, you know, public transport accessibility. You know, it's when you start really listening, it's when you start examining and looking at the fact that the education system is very ableist and is inherently difficult to navigate. So you might have a disabled employee who just doesn't have the qualifications that you're looking for simply because the local college wasn't accessible. And then it goes, you realize how much deeper it runs. So I think, you know, for employers, it goes back to this open and honesty, asking the questions, offering the flexibility, offering hybrid working, you know, anything that perhaps a disabled employee needs, because often people refer to what are reasonable adjustments. And something I would always say back is, what you think is reasonable could also just be what that person needs to live.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily going above and beyond. It could just be the absolute basic. And I think a lot of employees get hung up on the idea of what is reasonable. But is it reasonable that your business has three steps into it and actually you've just revamped an entire office and not bothered to remove the steps? If you ask me, that's not reasonable. If you ask them, it is. So I think it goes much further in looking at, you know, is it reasonable or is it what you should actually do as a person to help society and create a more inclusive society as a whole?
That's a whole nother podcast episode. I think that point about zooming out though and not just thinking about the immediate field of vision in terms of whether it's a workplace is accessible and inclusive is such a brilliant point, because like you say, there are so many broader barriers that before you even get to the door of a workplace that impact your ability to say yes or no to working there. So I think that is just so thought-provoking. And yeah, I can't thank you both enough for your honesty in this conversation and for making the time to have it with me today. Where can people find out more about your work with WizKids, Ella? Because I'm sure lots of listeners will want to follow up with that.
Yeah, so WizKids obviously have their website. I'm on there. There's lots on social media about WizKids social media. And there's also things like a lot of Times articles recently have come out about us. So there's lots of different places. But the best place to start is always WizKids social media and website. Pretty much a lot of things I'll be doing are on there. And then it's all linked to me, really, and to the board. And I think we're also on we've got various different lists and achievements as well.
It's amazing. Well, we will keep being allies to you and supporting your work wherever we can, because we really, really value you as a colleague and the work that you do. And like we say, we're so, so grateful to be able to learn from you and to work with you. So thank you both so much. I've loved this conversation and I will see you both soon.
Thank you.